STEM experience. Okay. I am often the only science, technology, engineering, or math. Well, they will have also had some math, right? But as far as physical sciences go, I'm probably, you know, except for the ones that decide to major, right? I'm often the only opportunity, right? And in our popular literature, what do you guys think? Do you think that the conversation is open and forthright and honest?
No.
Do you think that the conversation has somewhat balkanized based on various special interests?
Well, I think the oil industry, for one thing, is acknowledging it and talking about the wonderful things they're doing to mitigate. And I find that disgusting.
Distressing?
Disgusting.
Disgusting.
And distressing.
Disgusting. Yeah. Well, the reason that I include this topic in a geology class, and the reason that I close with this topic in a geology class, is because the students that I work with are going to be the voters that hopefully make a difference. They are all, in my case, I teach in Queens, New York. They are students who are living in the neighborhoods that are most affected by climate change, most affected by air pollution. Their health is most affected by what we do or do not do, or how we produce electricity, because all of them are adjacent to the infrastructure that we use to create this. And all of them live atop municipal infrastructure that was designed for the last century's sea levels, right? When you read stories about basements being flooded in New York, that's where my students are living. They're living in those basements, right? So I think that this is a critical topic. And the way that I try to frame this topic to kind of set aside the balkanization is to just present it from the physical science aspect first. And then we talk about the societal impacts. So let's start with our land use acknowledgement. Obviously, I do my research, I do my work at Queens College. Everything that I'm going to present to you today, this is not my field of study, but it is a field of passion. I do my work where the Lenape, the Lekwai, and the Manicoc made their homes and cared for the glacially shaped and structured place where Queens College is. And today, we're going to go straight to learning objectives, right? We want to talk about how climate changes, right? Are there natural things that impact our climate, right? We're talking about what greenhouse gases are from a physical standpoint and why they do what they do, right? Because I feel that once we kind of understand the mechanisms, it's a lot easier to get past some of the fluff in the conversation. And then we're going to talk about why we know climate change is caused by human activity, right? And to do that, we have to use data, right? So today is the one day that I'm going to ask you guys to look at a lot of graphs with me, look at a lot of data with me, right? Because this is the part of the conversation where once you understand the axes, in the presence of a true understanding of the mechanisms, it's hard to tell yourself a different story. Okay? So can we do data today?
Sure.
All right. So here we go. Let's pick up where we left off, because we spent a lot of time talking about glaciation. We talked about this last glaciation. We drew a picture on the board that talked about the war between these two ice sheets that created Lake Chelan. We talked about how we carved this amazing valley that we spend our time in, right? But let's talk about what causes an ice age, right? And whether or not we've got these in the future. Does anybody here remember the news of the 1970s as we were headed into our next ice age?
Well, I heard that people were worried about
that. I know that the people in Buffalo thought that, right? Well, let's see if we can find some support for that. The most recent ice age wasn't just a long period of glacial advance, right? In the Northern Hemisphere, we had four major episodes of glacial advance, and we can kind of see evidence of two of them here. This is Long Island. We looked at it the other day, right? And these are essentially the results. If you look at the broader selection of the East Coast, you can see all the way up through the Cape, the evidence of these two glacial episodes where the terminal moraine ended right there. And these outwashed plains make the rest of our island, right? And so we can see easily on this map those two glaciations. But there's more evidence that's underwater right now, right? Offshore on the East Coast, we see all sorts of evidence where the sea levels were much lower than they currently are, right? Where Native Americans had their homes and what's now covered by water, right? And if we look forward using all of the mathematical predictions that are associated with how we're changing our climate, well, I don't exactly have oceanfront property in Arizona. But I wouldn't necessarily have thought that I could make a hit out of oceanfront property in Memphis. Right?
What would the total level rise be?
I think that's a couple hundred meters. Right? It's quite a bit. Right? So let's look at this from a historical perspective. So just to orient you to this graph, once again, we're going to start looking at a lot of data. This is the age of the Earth in millions of years ago. So this is 3,000 million years ago. This is the Archean. This is the Proterozoic. We've got our Cambrian, here's our Jurassic, Jurassic, Cretaceous, right? Here's that KT boundary event 66 million years ago. What's this line over here telling us? Yeah, it's temperature, right? On this side of the axis is warmer, on this side of the axis is cooler. So let's look at the Quaternary. Let's look at our most recent time, and I want you to think about what's remarkable about this period compared to the rest of geologic time. If this is our kind of our median value, right? What you can see here is that from the Cretaceous up until present, right, there's a lot of variability here in the Quaternary, but just on average, where are we compared to the rest of geologic history? Quite a bit cooler, right? And remarkably stable. We haven't had these types of really big. So here's whoosh, whoosh, right? Oh boy, whoosh, right? The Earth has experienced extremely long periods of very warm weather, right? But our modern world, the world that we live in, the world that we depend on, has had remarkably stable temperature conditions that have been on average cool compared to Earth's history, right? What's this showing us? So here's sea level today. Here's our Cenozoic, right? What have we been doing? Here's the Mesozoic. There's our KT boundary event. What's been happening to sea level for the last 66 million years? Right? You remember we talked to the early slide? When do you think we had those civilizations or those settlements that were currently offshore that are currently underwater? We can kind of see it on this graph right at the very end, right? Here's where we are almost, I think this is in meters, right? So at the very highest, we're about 250 meters above where we are. There's 0 meters, there's negative 100 meters. It looks like at our lowest point right here, we are what? And that's an average globally, right? Different places, that's going to be different, right? But just in general, we've been, as the world has been pretty much on a cooling trend, our sea level has been dropping, and most of the world that we currently inhabit has been exposed during this period, right? The lion's share of Earth, humanity's population, lives in the regions that have been exposed through this drop in sea level. New York City is a coastal city in the era of sea level rise. Charleston is a coastal city in the era of sea level rise. Houston is a coastal city in the era of sea level rise. Bangladesh is a coastal nation in the era of sea level rise. Right? So, let's talk about how this changes, what the actual mechanisms are. Right? Well, there are some ideas. Right? Climate is changed as the Earth's orbit of the sun adjusts. These are called Milankovitch cycles, right? And there are three different ways that this system varies, okay? One is that the actual orbit of the Earth around the sun sometimes is more elliptical and sometimes is less elliptical. And this varies regularly. We can predict this, the way this system works, right? The other thing that's different is the Earth tilts. The actual tilt of our Earth varies as we go around the sun.
Question.
Yeah.
Is that the wobble?
No. The wobble is a different thing. We also precess. Right? There's a wobble that's associated with how we go around the sun. Do you think we can see that in the data? I bet we can, right? The next large change is similar to the ones in the last ice edges, right? These changes predict that our next ice age is due in about 30,000 years. So how does climate change? The big first thing is we have changes in the amount of incoming solar irradiation, right? That is fundamentally related to the Milankovitch cycles, right? The second way that we change is change in reflectivity. Has anybody ever here walked out into I got a question. Do you like to wear light colors or dark colors when it's super duper hot? Light colors, right? What about car colors? Has anybody ever done an experiment where you touched a dark car and touched a light car? Well, don't touch the dark car without some caution, right? Because as a person who used to be a car dealer, a car salesman, I can tell you that the dark ones are very, very, very hot. The light ones, not so much, right? Less hot, right? You can certainly experience this when you choose whether to walk on a light-colored sidewalk or a dark-colored asphalt, right? Mm-hmm. Once again, do so with caution on a hot day. But this change in reflectivity is called albedo. Now, albedo is the fraction of solar radiation that is reflected back into space, right? What are the kinds of things that can reflect like that? Ice is nice and white, right? So more ice is more reflective surface, correct? What about cloud cover? All right. What about seawater? What color is seawater? Dark by comparison, right? Certainly not white, right? So the real problem here is that we've got a feedback loop that's starting to develop. That is developing, that's already in process, right? Where when we remove ice cover, if we warm the Earth and we reduce the amount of ice, amount of polar ice, the amount of Antarctic ice, the thing that goes with it is reflectivity. If we change white ice for dark seawater, we've gone from something that's reflective to something that absorbs heat. The more we do that, what happens to the ice?
Melt.
We melt more ice, what happens to the amount of heat we absorb? Right? So, we've got Milankovitch cycles, that's big thing number one. We've got albedo, that's big thing number two. What do you think big thing number three is?
Carbon load.
The actual composition of our atmosphere, right? It's called the greenhouse effect, right? And I would posit that you guys have all experienced this fairly regularly, right? Pretty much every time you get under a blanket, right? And you trap your own heat, and you sleep very comfortably, or not comfortably, as the case may be, right? The greenhouse effect. We've all heard that term, right? Let's talk about how it works, right? Because I think that the mechanisms here are very important, right? So, let's take a moment, let's be reflective, let's list and describe each of the three primary mechanisms of climate change, and then we're going to talk about the greenhouse effect. I don't think anybody has any paper, do they? Well, I think we can just review. Let's make sure that we all got them down. Right? What are they?
I forget the big long word, but when the orbit changes from elliptical to less elliptical.
Yep. So we can just think of that. We don't really need the big fancy words. Milankovitch cycles is what we're describing, right? But we can just say variations in the amount of solar energy we receive, right? Variations of that input would be fine, right? What's big thing number two?
Albedo.
The amount of reflectivity that we have on our surface. And then, we've got our greenhouse gases as our big thing. All right, so would you guys be surprised to know that there are good parts to greenhouse gases? It's not all bad, right? And matter of fact, I would contend that the only reason this is a habitable planet is because we have greenhouse gases, right? So they're an important part of our system. But there is a bad, right? And that's the effect of the last century of carbon pollution. And then there's the ugly, right? And that ugly is getting uglier all the time and less uncertain all the time, right? So can we think about Earth as just a rock? Just a rock. Just a rock sitting in space, right? Anybody here a David Bowie fan? Elton John fan? Is it cold in space? Cold? Cold as hell, right? All right. So the place that I want to get to is a recognition that we are just this ball sitting in a vacuum. Right? Does the earth feel heat from the sun? Does it? Well, how is that when it's so cold in space? This is kind of a head scratcher. Yes.
Not heat, sunlight.
That's correct. But what is sunlight? Is it radiant heat? Mm-mm. I got a question. Does when you put something in a microwave, is it when you turn it on, is heat coming out of anywhere? What's happening?
Molecules
are moving, but why are they moving?
They're being struck by the microwaves.
Electromagnetic radiation, right? So we're this big rock, we're sitting in a vacuum, and what the sun puts out is electromagnetic radiation, okay? Can you guys do this with me just right now? I want you to think about what difference in wavelength means. We've got a lot of people that do music here, right? All right. So let's do this. Put your hand in your throat, and let's hit a high note. Oh. Let's hit a low note. Oh. Okay. If I had a chart here that was looking at the whole spectrum of radiation of wavelengths, what we would see is that EM radiation is really high frequency. Much higher than our voices. But we can use this as an analogy. It's high. Beep, 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 beep. Right? Does this make sense to everybody? Okay. Now, what we're getting from the sun is that high frequency radiation. Beep, 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 beep. In order to create heat, those high frequency, short wavelength radiation waves have to be changed into long wavelength infrared waves. Womp, 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 womp. Right? And that happens when the sunlight hits the earth. Right? When that EM radiation interacts with our solid earth. So let's think for a second about the moon and the earth. Are these, for the purposes of this conversation, about the same distance from the sun?
Yes.
All right. But it's different on the moon, right? No. I mean, does anybody want to build a condo there? No. Not me. Right? All right. So here, let's consider the moon. We are approximately the same distance from the sun, but on average, the temp is 30 degrees C colder. Can we think for a moment whether that's a lot or a little? Oh, that's a lot. If the Earth were 30 degrees C colder, what would the Earth look like? Would we have liquid oceans? We'd be an ice ball, right? That's the average temp. But the range, that's even worse. The range goes from negative 170 degrees C to 100 degrees C. We go from almost absolute zero to boiling. Whew. I mean, I've actually thought that the range of temperatures we've experienced here at Holden have been a little bit on the wide side, right? But it's not that wide, right? The takeaway is that shortwave radiation from the sun is not enough to make a habitable environment, right? We're receiving the same here and here, right? But there's a difference because we can't live here. Not very nice, right? And it's because that low wavelength radiation, that infrared, womp, 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 it's being captured, right? It's being captured by our atmosphere. So let's think about this. So here's our good. We've got incoming solar radiation. Do it with me. Beep, 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 beep. Oh, come on. You guys are not that cool. All right, incoming solar radiation. Beep, 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 beep. Outgoing infrared radiation. Womp, 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 womp. And our atmosphere is capturing a large portion of that. It's why we have the habitable space that we do. Now, the question that you should be asking is, what is, what's here? What's the blanket made out of? Is this wool? Down? Cotton? Right? That fuzzy plastic stuff that you think might catch on fire? No? All right. Most of it is polar molecules, right? And I want you to look at those polar molecules for a moment because they are impressive. They're beefy, right? Look at that thing. You got O2 with those big double bonds, O2, right? Very, very sturdy structure, O2, right? What about nitrogen? Oh my goodness. N2, that thing is as stiff as a board, right? Two molecules on a triple bond. Whoa. N2. Would anybody want to dance with either of these? Right? I mean, they don't look like they can move all that much, do they? But this party has got more, right? That's 99%. But the rest of it's important because the rest of it includes polar molecules. Water vapor is a polar molecule. You pointed out that when we turn on the microwave, it's because molecules are moving. Which molecules are moving? Man, they just gotta shake. Look at the asymmetry here. You got the negative over here, you got the positive over here. And when they feel that infrared, they like to wiggle. Right? They're not like O2 or N2. I mean, they feel it. Right? Can you guys feel it? Right? Because that's what's making your microwave work. You turn on those EM waves, and those water molecules, they go. And they create friction and heat. Right? But that's not all. We've got carbon dioxide. And I want you to look for a moment at the structure of that carbon dioxide molecule. Is it beefy? Oh, no. It's floppy. It is big and long, and it's got this big carbon in the middle and two oxygens over here, and it just goes, it's just all over the place, right? It's easily excitable by those infrared rays, that infrared radiation. And I would like to try to do the dance that methane will do, right? But that's got that big central C with all of these very small single-bonded hydrogens. They can move all over the place, right? You guys ready to dance the system? All right, let's do it. Please everybody stand up. Please everybody stand up. Best moves gets extra points, but here we go. We've got incoming solar radiation. Beep, 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 beep. We've got outgoing infrared radiation. Womp, 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 womp. And then we've got interactions. We've got our blocky molecules. Nonpolar. Don't dance with me. Right? Then we've got polar molecules. Our water molecules, right? And then we've got our floppy carbon dioxides. And then anybody that can do methane, please. Right? Right? Oh, yeah, we got some methanes. Right? Okay. All right, you guys can sit down. Thank you so much. All right, so what's our difference? What's the difference here? We've got a greenhouse effect. Let's compare some planets. So we've got Mars, Earth, and Venus. Venus has an actual temp of 460 degrees. If you took out the atmosphere, and this is much closer to the sun than we are, if you took away the atmosphere, the temp would be negative 53 degrees C. Right? So this is an atmosphere that's full of carbon dioxide, methane, and such. Greenhouse effect, 513 degrees C. This is our happy Earth. Actual temp, 15 degrees C, average. Temp without an atmosphere, negative 19 degrees C. Greenhouse effect, 34 degrees currently. Right? Mars, negative 55, negative 61. So essentially you go from a very rich in greenhouse gas atmosphere at Venus to a very happy to live on Cenozoic planet, Earth, to Mars with no greenhouse, almost no greenhouse effect at all. All right? Does this make sense to everybody? Yeah. From a mechanism standpoint, do you understand why those greenhouse gases do what they do? Right? All right. So, I think we've kind of done that. What do you think?
Yes.
You guys down with that?
Yep.
All right. So we're going to move right on. And we're going to talk about paleoclimatology. Right? And this is where this is how I get to put this into my class. Right? Because the way we understand most of this is through the study of Earth and the study of past climates through geology. Right? Because we're not there. We're not collecting air. Right? So we got to find some other way to do this. Right? And we can find physical examples of what our atmosphere was using everything from isotopes, right, to tree rings, to deposits in caves, to corals, to old shorelines, to sediments. But essentially what we're going to do is we're going to use evidence to make interpretations about the past. And let's think about one. Does anybody here like dragonflies, or do they kind of freak you out? You're kind of weird. And they're big, and they flap their wings, and they don't bite, but you know, they look like they could bite. Yeah, I would hate to get the first bite, right? Like I just kind of feel like that's a big bug, right? Well, what do you think? How do you think a dragonfly could help us understand past climate?
Well, when there was more oxygen in the air, there was.
We got a ringer. There's always a ringer in a class. We got a ringer. Yes, go ahead.
Well, they don't have a circulatory system like we do, so in order to get oxygen to reach different parts of their body, it's more difficult. If there's more oxygen, they can get bigger.
All right, let's leave the rest of that as the cliffhanger part of the story, because what he's telling us, this is a lungless thing, right? And so its ability to get oxygen through its extremities is actually not all that great, right? It doesn't have the same type of circulatory system that you and I have, that efficient transfer of oxygen. So its development is tied to how much oxygen it has access to, right? Okay, so this is carbon sequestration, right? And I think this is the big part of the conversation that we gotta wrap our heads around. Does everybody remember when we looked at that timeline through the Mesozoic into the Cenozoic, how we've been kind of on this continually cooler trend? Okay? Let's think about what caused that, right? Because the carbon cycle, as we discussed in our earlier, well, I've mentioned it as part of our celebration of Jubilee, is that every single year we have this explosion of growth in the spring where we create leaves and flowers and all sorts of life by taking carbon out of our atmosphere and putting it into those leaves. And then those leaves fall off, they decompose, they respire. They have to have oxygen to do that, right? And they put that carbon back in the air. It's just a cycle, right? Now, carbon sequestration is what happens when we remove those dead leaves, dead swamps, dead bogs, dead trees, dead plankton from an oxygen source. To respire, you must have oxygen, right? Just like you cannot burn, as soon as you have a fire in your kitchen, you cover it to smother the oxygen. You stop the respiration process by depriving it of oxygen. The stuff that was in your pan that could have burned off will not because it runs out of oxygen, right? If you clog your carburetor on your car cannot burn gasoline, right? And when we stop breathing, we stop processing carbon as well, right? So carbon sequestration happens when we take large amounts of organic material and we remove it from oxygen. And we can do that in a lot of different ways. But the most common way is we let it sink through stratified water, right? Something dies, anything dies, and it sinks. And it decomposes. And as it decomposes in that water, it uses the oxygen of that water. And in a stratified system, where the warm stuff is up here, the cold stuff is down here, without a mechanism to get this cold up there, the cold stays down here and becomes increasingly depleted in oxygen. Right? So we get these anoxic bottom conditions that can exist. We're currently having a problem with that in the Gulf of Mexico, right? But they certainly in swamp type areas. So when we have large portions of our marine systems shallow and anoxic, we have the ability to stack them with organic material that takes carbon out of the air, but never has the chance to respire it back into the air. Does this make sense? Okay. Because what I want you to consider is what happens if we were to increase the importance of burial, sequestration in this system. What happens to the overall carbon content of the atmosphere? What happens to the overall oxygen content of our atmosphere? And what happens to our temperature? Give this just a moment. Let's talk to each other. Let's do some chattering. And think about this problem. What happens if we bury more stuff? Yeah, if we remove it from oxygen, burial is just
covering a lid on it.
Yes, we put a lid on it. Who would like another moment? All right. As more vegetation is buried, less carbon is returned to the atmosphere. Therefore, less CO2. We had really large periods of our geologic history where the burial of plant matter happened at a very, very high rate. Rapid sea level rise and fall, repeatedly buried coastal vegetation. Think about the Everglades in Florida under shallow marine limestones, essentially locking that carbon material underground. Right, and this happened for millions of years. These seals sealed off thousands of billions of tons of vegetation making the Carboniferous very unique in that it sequestered a large portion of what had been always a very high carbon dioxide atmosphere on Earth, right? And the result was we had an extremely high oxygen content. This is the thing that I have nightmares about. If this is a normal, for scale, this is a modern dragonfly. This is a dragonfly when the atmosphere was up at around 35% oxygen. The more oxygen there is in the air, the larger the dragonfly can become. This had a wingspan of almost a meter. Right? Right now, our oxygen content is around 21%. But at 35%, we had the ability to make really big bugs. Right? Okay. So here's the bad. Modern climate. Anthropogenic activity has become a major factor in affecting climate change. Greenhouse gas concentrations have risen dramatically over the last century. Increased greenhouse gases have resulted in global changes in temperature, precipitation, snow, ice cover, sea level, storm intensity, you name it. Right? And just to give you an understanding of what the scale of this is, I want to look at some data. So does anybody recognize this spot? Yeah, Hawaii. Right? This is Mauna Loa. Right? Here's a topographical map, and you can kind of see that observatory is right at the top of a volcano. Can anybody think of why we might like to measure greenhouse gas at the top of a volcano?
You get a better average reading because you're far away from vegetation and its immediate effect.
You're so far away. Right? All right. So, any LA traffic in Mauna Loa? they have traffic jams nowadays, but by comparison to Queens Boulevard, not so bad, right? It's a volcano that doesn't have any vegetation on it, as was pointed out. So it doesn't have the type of seasonal variations that come with the dropping of leaves, right? And it's very high in the sky, right? So it's able to sample at kind of a broad average, right? Essentially, we're far from sources of pollution. We have high altitude. It's all hard rock. There's no soil. We're far from trees and plants. And perhaps most importantly, upwind from the volcanic crater itself. Right? Okay. So here's some data. This is 1 month at the Mauna Loa Observatory. This is November 9th, 2015. Tell me what you see. Let's describe the changes in CO2. Talk about when the average CO2 is highest and when the average CO2 is lowest. All right, just chat with your neighbor. Let's do some data crunching. You guys got to talk up too. Would anybody be willing to offer a summary of this data? So here's our x-axis. I'm sorry, there's our y-axis. Here's our x-axis. What's the basic trend?
Up.
So you see we're kind of lower on average here and we're higher on average here. So when's the average highest? We'd say end of month. Average lowest at the beginning of the month? Okay. You guys want some more data?
Yes, please.
Let's do some more data. Okay, let's do 6 months. Oh boy. Oh boy. What do you think now? Let's go ahead and do the same exercise. Describe the changes in the CO2. When's it highest? When's it lowest? And I think we can probably talk less about this one. You can kind of just share your answers. I I mean, these are real measurements. This is just data, right? No fake news. What do you think? What's happening?
Very
6 months. Okay. You guys want more data? How you feeling? Is it getting hot in here?
Yes.
All right. All right. What do you think's causing that pattern? Well, I'm going to give you more, but I want to know what you think is causing that pattern.
It might be the season.
Other volcano that's erupting?
This is from 2004. I'm not familiar of another eruption at this point. Anybody have another hypothesis?
It's in the fall. It's getting toward the summer. Winter is getting toward summer.
Every class is always a ringer. let's say that a little bit louder.
It starts kind of in the fall, but towards the spring it's getting warmer. It's heading for summer.
So we've got a hypothesis. Let's see if we can do some more data and see if we can confirm that hypothesis. All right. Well, I'm sorry. I actually gave the answer away. I'm not quite as good a mystery maker as I should have been. Carbon is fluxing from the biosphere to the atmosphere by respiration. So you're exactly right. Right? Let's look at the next 6 months. Does everybody feel more perhaps comforted now? It's not quite as dire as it looked originally, right? So we've got another 6 months. What's happening? Not so bad. Do you guys want more data?
No.
Well, should we stop? We should stop here. All right, let's do some more data. Well, first, just real quickly, what do you think? What are the changes in CO2? When's it highest? When's it lowest?
High in the summer, low in the fall.
So here's May, and we're low right here. Okay, let's keep going forward in time. Oh, what do you think is causing that pattern? Life. Right? This is the spring bloom, right?
Yeah.
All the flowers are blooming, right? Okay. Carbon is fluxing from the atmosphere into the biosphere. This is photosynthesis. Do you guys want some more data? All right. What do you see here? This is one year. Let's look at it really carefully and tell me what you see. What's the data say? Is it getting warm in here again? Yes, ma'am.
So the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere are kind of on opposite patterns of winter and summer.
Yeah, totally.
So then how do you make anything out of that?
Well, this is definitely a measurement of the pattern in the northern hemisphere.
It's not global.
Right. And there are two things to consider is that the northern and southern hemisphere, and we're gonna look at the differences between them in just a moment, have had different levels of response because there are different levels of pollution in our respective hemispheres, right? But can we agree, if we describe the changes in CO2, that we've got kind of an up and a down that's related to seasons? When's the highest CO2? When's the lowest CO2? Kind of is October-ish, right? Okay. So we had a highest concentration of 404, we had a lowest concentration of 397. Pretty reasonable. You guys want to see more data?
Yes.
Boy, I love it when we get a page turner. Oh, why is it not working? What did I do? Oh. We're giving away too much. Come on. We get closer? All right. Tell me what you see. That moment of relief that you had when you saw the cycle go back down, has it gone away? Are the CO2's levels the same as they were in the previous year?
No.
Hmm. Do you see a systematic trend?
Yes.
But there's only 2 years. Are the highs the same level? How do they differ?
Later is higher.
What about the lows? Are the lows the same level? How do they differ? Yeah, the highs are high and the lows are high. Okay. What do you think is causing these changes? Right? That's the signal from anthropogenic carbon pollution. And we've been collecting this. This is a very, very famous curve. This is the curve from Mauna Loa, 1958 to the present. You can see here's 1960. We had these levels of CO2. Remark to yourself that this is in the 300-ish area and that we are currently in 2015. That's the 400-ish area. Pretty convincing story when you really break it down and look at the data, right? And then when you combine that with an understanding of how those molecules behave in our atmosphere, right? So, long-term trends in atmospheric CO2. How do you feel about making big changes just based on 30 years of data? Do you feel like that would be a sound rationale for massive policy shifts? I don't know. I'm kind of a truster, but I can see where that would be an argument, right? So, what do you say we do this and look at a little bit longer time frame? Can anybody think of a way that we can get some old air?
Yep.
There you go. Just like what we were talking about. Let's look at 800,000 years. Okay? So here's 800,000 years. Here's CO2 concentration in parts per million. What did we see in 1958-ish? We saw a line that was kind of like that, right? And what you can see here is the natural cycle, right? These, do you see how far away these peaks are? Boom, 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 boom. What's causing that?
Ice ages.
Ice ages, he says? Say again?
The Milankovitch cycles.
Milankovitch cycles, right? You're roughly seeing in this graph the impact of Milankovitch, okay? And so the Earth's CO2 content responds to these changes in climate that are associated with the changes in incoming solar radiation and albedo, like this.
Question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's the theory of that?
So you've got three different things, and they kind of operate on three different cycles. So you've got the changes in the ellipticalness of our orbit, that changes in about 120,000 year cycle. You've got the changes in the tilt of the Earth. I think that's on something like a 30-year cycle, and the wobble is on about a 12,000 year cycle. And so we get our ice ages when you can take all of those signals and kind of add them up into the same low spot or the same high spot.
It's mainly the wobble and the ellipsis. Well, those change at a way slower rate.
These are happening at about 100,000 years, right? There's 800 or so, 750 or so, 650 or so. We've got this period right here, but these big cycles are happening on about 100,000 year kind of a pattern, right? And they're very consistent with those changes in our orbital characteristics, combined with the albedo effects that come with them, right? But there's a terrifying part of this graph that we haven't really paid much attention to yet, right? Because when we put this line on a geologic timescale and then try to put it in the context of what's happened in the 20th century, our ability to read this data just goes out the window. Calculate your slope. Right? Rise over run. Tell me this. Because when I see this, rise over run makes me want to run.
Well, but the previous one was very similar. Look at this previous spike we can see in its entirety.
Right.
No, you mean like
120
million years ago?
We're way up here. Right? And if you were to actually calculate these slopes, right, which is difficult to do, one of the things that I do with students is I have them make this graph and I have them calculate maximum slope through each of these periods and find maximums. What you would see is that this is 6 times faster than anything that's happened in the last 800,000 years, right? Boom. Maximum has always been between 250 and 280 until recently. Now we're at 400 plus, right? Yes, ma'am.
I realize it's kind of a short blip, but during COVID, the carbon output really dropped pretty significantly. Do you have any graphs that show what that looked like?
I don't. I do know that people, that there are graphs that show that effect, right? As we were running cars less, we were burning less fuel, mm-hmm. right? One of the really things that's kind of interesting about all of this is that there's a part of this argument that says, okay, well, where does this carbon come from? Is this carbon fossil fuel pollution, right? Because there are natural sources for carbon dioxide, right? Volcanoes, sure. right? In fact, some of these periods we've discussed in our class were periods of amazingly large volcanic activity, but we don't really observe that happening today. We don't have a Columbia flood basalt being created.
Forest fires too, right?
Right. Forest fires are certainly they have a signal, right? But the thing is that we know, right? We know we have the ability to sort out the portion of this that comes from burning of fossil fuels and everything else. How? How do we know that? How do we know how much fuel we burned? I mean, like, if I burn a barrel of oil, do I know how much CO2 comes out of that? Is that something that I can determine empirically? If I have a ton of coal and I burn it, do I have the ability to measure how much CO2 is associated with that ton of coal? Okay, then how do I know? Because if we drill it, if we pump it, we burn it. There is no place that we put oil. If it comes out of the ground, it gets used. All of it, right? So we've got this cycle that's part natural and part not. And we can quantify that, right? So let's look how this has actually played out. Right? So here's carbon emissions in millions of tons per year. You can compare United States to Canada to the EU to the Russian Federation. Here's China, Japan, India, Indonesia, Australia, right? Now, if I wanted to have a biased conversation, if I wanted to be a defender, I'd say, whoa, wait a minute. We got a lot more people here. That's not fair. Right? Okay, well, let's look at it. Since 1850. Well, wait a minute. I'm not sure that's fair. Right? You know, essentially, this is us since our Industrial Revolution. We've got other nations that are trying to achieve the same. They want the same two cars in a garage that we have. Mm-hmm. Right? That's our collective contribution to this problem. Right? And the question that we got to figure out is whether or not we care. Because there are nations that are disappearing underwater right now whose portion of this is almost non-existent. Right? Okay. Well, let's look at this. Want to take this a little more personally? Can we take it personally?
Per capita?
Let's take it personally.
Per capita.
Right? Here's the U.S. Here's Canada. There's the EU. Smaller cities. Australia. Right? Air conditioning and long drives. Right? All right. So here's what this has looked like. Now, this is kind of an interesting graph. It's one of my favorites. It's the one of the ones, you know, one of the things that we do in my classes is that we spend a lot of time trying to write proper figure captions. I feel like that's a way that students can really get engaged in what data actually says, is thinking about how you would describe the figure. But in this case, we've got global temperature on this, and this is an anomaly map where essentially we've taken the median, or in this case I think it's the mean, right? And we've plotted everything else in relationship to this mean. So this is our mean temperature during this period of time. During that same period of time, this plots as a negative anomaly, negative anomaly, negative anomaly, negative anomaly, a little bit of a warm period, negative, 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 and then whoa.
Yeah.
Right? This is the kind of graph that often gets abused in science policy conversations, right? I once saw one of the most shocking congressional hearings I've ever seen, where essentially somebody took that day, see this number right here? Mm-hmm. You see that number right there? Mm-hmm. Basically, they took a very small portion of this graph and said, oh, we got no problem. It's paused. There's a pause, right? But it hadn't. Right? Here's how these things correlate to everything else that we care about. Here's our CO2 concentration. This is this goes back, 400,000 years? So it's half of that other graph, right? So here's our CO2 concentration peaks. Here's our global temperature concentration peaks. You can see how well correlated those are. Can everybody say correlation doesn't equal causation? But it should make you suspicious. Right? Here's sea level. Boom, 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 boom. And here's where we are. There's where we are. And there's where we are. Right? The Earth's response to greenhouse gases is incontrovertible at this point. We've got less sea ice, we've got higher sea surface temperatures, we've got higher heat ocean content, sea level is rising, temperature erosion is rising, the humidity in our atmosphere is rising, the air temperature in the near surface is rising, glaciers are decreasing, snow cover is decreasing, and the temperature over land is increasing. And I would imagine that almost none of these can be turned around in the next 50 years. But perhaps the 50 years after that, we've got some hope if we get on it, right? And so this is a problem that requires empathy, right? This is a problem that requires caring beyond our own economic interests, right? And recognizing that the long-term interests of people we do care about are directly tied to the outcomes that we choose for them. I want to introduce you to Queen's College most famous professor. This is a man named Barry Commoner. He was the start, we now have an institute named the Commoner Institute, and he did his work at Queens College in the 1970s. And he gave us four laws, four rules, four things to think about. And if there's anything that I want everybody here to take from our time together, it's these four things. I want you to commit them to your hearts. Right? Big thing number one. Everything is connected to everything else. There is only one ecosphere. All living organisms have to share that ecosphere. What affects one affects all. Everything must go somewhere. We understand that at Holden better than almost anywhere I've ever been. Right? There is no waste in nature. There is no away. Every away you can imagine is somebody else's here. Right? There is no away. Nature knows best. Humankind has fashioned technology to improve upon nature, but any such change in a natural system is likely to be detrimental to that system. Right? Yes?
Francis Bacon, nature to be commanded must be obeyed.
I've never heard that before, but I'm going to carry it with me. Francis Bacon, nature to be
commanded must be obeyed.
Must be obeyed. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Exploitation of nature will inevitably involve the conversion of resources from useful to useless. Every action has a response. So here we go. You guys ready for it? Here's my final catalyst question to you. What is a catalyst? Take a moment, talk about it. You guys have spent the last 4 days answering catalyst questions. I want to know what a catalyst is. Yes?
Something that facilitates change without being changed itself.
A trigger to change? Any other definitions? This is it comes from the Greek. Right? First definition is a substance that increases the rate of a chemical reaction without itself undergoing any permanent chemical change. That's the use of catalysts that we use in a chemistry classroom. But the use of the catalyst that I have in this classroom is right here. It's a person or thing that precipitates an event. All this time, I want you to know that the catalyst is you. My catalyst questions are for you. Right? And that's it. Thank you very much. Thank you for spending this time with me. I'm so happy to have been here. Tim, you got any questions?
Be the second most